May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Jeff Anderson, registration number 14907. I'm with the law firm of Sweetbaum Sands Anderson. With me at council table today is Hillary Anderson, another attorney in our office. And with us in the courtroom today is Mr. Gary Lenski, the appellant, and my client today. When Mr. Lenski began this quiet title action 10 years ago, he sought the quiet title to a little over a 20-acre parcel of property in Gardner, Colorado that was known as No Man's Land. When the trial court concluded the case last year, there was a little over 20-acre parcel of property in Gardner, Colorado known as No Man's Land. Well, that's not the way quiet title cases are supposed to work. Rule 105 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure calls for a complete adjudication of rights and a complete determination of the controversy. CRS Section 38-34-101 declares that the public policy of this state requires courts to construe all real estate laws so that real estate titles are more secure and marketable. No man's land is not secure and marketable. No reported quiet title case has ever left quiet title property without an owner like this. It's literally unprecedented. The trial court initially entered this decree in October of 2002, and it wasn't until 6.5 years later that these defendants, the contesters we call them, because it was only some of the defendants that were named, the appellants here, challenged the decree. They made a claim to approximately 1 1/3 acres of the 22 1/3 acres that were involved in the October 2002 quiet title decree. Defendants' claims amounted to 6% of the quiet title property. So in other words, they made no claim at all to the 94%, to the remaining 94%. Now that's why I have the demonstrative exhibit here, because that shows the quiet title property and the properties that were being claimed by the defendants here. The properties claimed by these defendants are shown in dark shading on the demonstrative exhibit. Now that dark rectangle over to the right, that's just an exhibit sticker, so that's not property that's being claimed. But all that property that's in the middle there, between those dark shaded areas, that's property that the trial court adjudicated in October 2002 that said Mr. Lenski was the owner of, that these defendants made no claim to. They were just claiming these little pieces around the edges. The four groups of defendants here, four different property owners, some of them were husbands and wives, and I think the Trujillos were a father and son. They just claimed these little parts around the edges. But the problem was that the trial court here, upon the challenge of the defendants, threw out the entire quiet title decree, all 22 1/3 acres, even though only 1 1/3 acres was being challenged.
Anderson, let me ask you this. When this Mr. Lenski first purchased the property, what he thought he was purchasing was a house and 1 acre or so. Is that correct?
That's
not,
right.
Not, he never thought he was purchasing the 23 acres.
Not at first, no.
Okay, so I understand that this is prior to the 2008 amendment to the Quiet Title Statute, but now that that amendment is in place requiring some good faith aspect, does that make a difference on the line of cases that you say no quiet title cases left land unadjudicated?
Not at all, Your Honor. The amendment I think you're talking about was the amendment to the Adverse Possession Statute,
right?
38-41-101.
Correct.
And that changed the elements that you need to prove to obtain title by adverse possession. Now, adverse possession is a substantive legal theory of how you might acquire real estate. Quiet title, on the other hand, as described by Rule 105, is merely a procedure. Rule 105 sets up the procedure. So if you're going to quiet title to a piece of property, you fit yourself into the procedure of Rule 105, but you still need to have some sort of substantive claim to fit into it, whether it's adverse possession or prescriptive easement or a deed, that sort of thing.
I may have inadvertently said quiet title statute, but what I meant is adverse possession. The aspect of good faith and adverse possession, how would that affect this case, let's say if it were filed post-2008 instead of pre?
I don't think it would affect it at all. And the reason for that is because that statute came effective on July 1, 2008. And the the legislative history on that, and I was involved in testifying before the legislature on that, and we talked to the legislature about how you could not have a situation where a quiet title case had ripened by July 1 of 2008 and then required a heightened standard, because that would be an unconstitutional taking of real estate. It requires a higher burden. The cases on adverse possession state that once the 18-year statute has run, the claimant owns the property. All you have to do is go to court to adjudicate it. So if a party already had title to property by July 1, 2008, then the new statute is not going to affect party's claim at all. Otherwise, you'd be requiring new burdens for property that's already been obtained by the claimant.
And I think in Gordon Leverage, there's a footnote that talks about that amendment. And in that case, the division described it as cases filed after July 1st, 2008, and not necessarily title ripening. Is that a part of the legislative history?
Well, the statute itself says that it will specifically apply to cases filed on and after July 1, 2008. The legislative history describes the three different possibilities that you could have. One is that title has already ripened by July 1, 2008. The second one is that adverse possession has started sometime before July 1, 2008, but the 18 years have not passed. And then the third one is that some adverse possession starts after July 1, 2008. It's that first scenario that I believe will be outside of the new statute, and it would be under the old one. So if for some reason this case was refiled after July 1, 2008, I think the exact same standard of proof and other burdens would apply here. But, of course, this case was filed on in October of 2001, almost exactly 10 years ago. So there's no question that as far as the existing case goes, we're under the old statute. Does that answer your question?
So what are we supposed to do with some pretty specific findings of fact along the way by the trial court judge? And specifically, I'm thinking that the trial court found that fences and structures belonging to plaintiff's surrounding neighbors were located on the subject property, that some of plaintiff's neighbors occupied portions of the subject property, that a copy of the petition for quiet title with a summons was not served upon any of plaintiff's neighbors because plaintiff did not want them to have notice of his quiet title action. Those are findings that were made by the trial court in this case, right?
Right. I think at that point, this court should look at Ginsburg versus Stanley Aviation and the Camp Bird case, which was a case that Judge Taubman was on just 2 years ago from the Court of Appeals, that says that if a party having an interest in real estate is not named in a quiet title action, their interest is simply not affected. Now, the trial court here found that these defendants had been denied their due process rights because of that. But that's completely outside the bounds of quiet title cases. Lobato versus Taylor, leading case on this from the Colorado Supreme Court from 2003, from the San Luis Valley, where the court found that additional property owners in Castillo County should have been given notice of a Torrens Title Registration Act in federal court in the 1960s, the same sort of notice and service required in a quiet title case. The court did not find that those parties were denied due process. It just said that those parties were not affected by the federal court's rulings in the 1960s, and that they could then come back and open up the case again. So I think that the trial court went too far when it said that people that didn't get notification had their due process rights violated. They simply could come back another day, which they did, and claim that they've got some interest in the property. Now, as far as were they in possession and that sort of thing, 22 acres is a fairly good-sized piece of property. If you look at the dimensions, and by the way, this demonstrative here is page 261 in the record, so you can look it up on the CD. And you can see the measurements. And we're talking 900 feet, 800 feet in various directions, which, you know, 3 football fields in length. And so this is a pretty good sized piece of property. And whether somebody's fence overlapped just a little bit, well, it's hard to tell without actually doing a boundary survey, which I don't think is required in a Colorado quiet title case. And Lobato versus Taylor says so, that you only have to check what's of record. And Mr. Lenski did that.
Mr. Anderson, may I ask you a related question about the one named defendant, Agnes Quillian?
Sure.
It appears that you were saying in your briefs that you had made a diligent effort to determine whether Ms. Quillian was still alive. Yet, am I correct in that regard?
That's right. Mr. Lenski spent a fair bit of time trying to find out if she was alive, or if not, whether there were any probate proceedings, whether there were any heirship proceedings, whether there were any heirs that were available at all, and he couldn't find anything. When he filed the quiet title case in October of 2001, he was not able to determine conclusively that she had passed away by that time.
Well, I'm at a loss to understand what actually happened, because, as you know, the trial court said that when Mr. Lenski filed the proceedings, he knew that Ms. Quillian had been dead for a long period of time. And yet somebody at some point must have determined when she actually passed away. Is that information in the record at all?
I have seen no information in the record as to when Ms. Quillian actually died. I have no idea.
Apparently it's undisputed that she did pass away.
Apparently she is no longer with us, that's right. But I think that the trial court's findings were erroneous on the point that Mr. Lenski knew in October 2001 that she was dead. Mr. Lenski's affidavit indicates that he learned, it was learned is what he said, that she had passed away. And by that he meant that he learned later that she had died, after October 2001.
2001, would a record search have shown the other defendants who later surfaced in this case as being property owners of that disputed property?
The surveyor that Mr. Lenski hired did a record search, and he did not find it. He testified in the October 2009 hearing that you would have to do a boundary survey to find that. Mr. Gonzalez, the defendant surveyor who did this demonstrative exhibit, said that he had to survey all of the defendant's properties, so not only the quiet title property, but the surrounding properties, too, to see how they all matched up. And again, Lobato does not require that. Unless there are any other questions, I'd like to reserve my last couple minutes, but if you have a question, I'd be happy to answer it.
That's fine, Mr. Anderson. You can reserve the rest of your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please the court. My name is Todd Kettlecamp. I'm from the law firm of Kettlecamp Young and Kettlecamp PC in Pueblo. I represent Gary DiDomenico, the Trujillos, the Coins, and Carol McDonald. Chuck Coyne wanted to be here today, but he was thrown off his horse on Friday and is in the hospital. My registration number is 15095. Your Honors, the trial court was correct in vacating the quiet title decree. Mr. Lenski argues to you that rather than vacating the decree, there should have been the exercise of a judicial scalpel. You may have read that in the brief. What he was suggesting was that the trial court should have carved off those gray areas representing the overlap. The court should know that at the time, the court didn't have any legal description in order to do that, number one. Couldn't have done that, even if they wanted to. At the trial court, the arguments were made by Mr. Lenski that my clients did not own or possess the areas in the overlap. At the Court of Appeals, they're now acknowledging that, yes, in fact, they were the owners of and the possessors of those parcels. Now, there was a similar argument made to the trial court. They didn't use the analogy to a judicial scalpel, but there was the argument made to the judge at the time. It's at the transcript, page 667 and 668. The argument was, Your Honor, there's an overlap here, so isn't there a way to preserve the balance of the decree? The trial court's response to that at page 672 and through 675 was, quote, you can't put the horse before the cart and decide the merits. That is not what the issue is today. The issue before the court at the time was whether or not my client's rights to be notified had been violated. And in fact, we established that they should have received personal notice. They should have received a summons and a complaint. So you see the argument being advanced by Mr. Lenski today that there should have been this judicial scalpel is flawed. It's flawed for two very important reasons. Number one, the cases are clear that where under a Rule 60B3 motion, a trial court has no discretion, such as pulling out a judicial scalpel and carving off the decree. Mr. Lenski knows this. It's reflected in his reply brief, citing the case of Goodman Associates, LLC v. WP Mountain Properties, and In Re Marriage of Stroud. The judgment is void or it isn't, and relief must be afforded accordingly. So, Your Honors, they're suggesting that the trial court had discretion to carve up a void judgment when that just simply is not the law. The second flaw in the argument is what I call the single proceeding rule, as stated in the case of Keith v. Kinney, 961 P. 2nd 516. It was cited at pages 15 and 26 in the amended answer brief. The principle of law that the trial court was referring to on October 13th, 2009, when the trial court said, you can't put the horse before the cart, what they're referring to is the single proceeding rule, as I call it. Parties with a material interest are necessary parties in a single proceeding because of the ramification of each claim on the other. That's why the court was saying, you can't ask me to address the merits of these people, their claim at this point in time. You need to start over, and you need to give people who have an interest notice of these proceedings. There are no legal or factual grounds to support Mr. Lenski's argument. And as you know, we're seeking our attorney's fees at this stage of the proceeding as well. Your Honors, the court did not err in granting the defendant's motion for summary judgment. There is an argument in their brief at this stage that that my clients no longer had any standing. That argument was never made at the trial court. Never made. This is the first time that it's come up. And the basis for the argument, as I understand it, is that because in the amended and supplemental complaint, by shrinking the amount of property in the legal description, that they had somehow removed standing. The standing argument was never made at the trial court.
Mr. Kettlecamp, in the trial court's order in 2009, the trial court did address standing and said that the plaintiff's argument that defendants lack standing is without merit.
There was a standing argument made in connection with the counterclaims, Your Honor. If you go back and look at the record, there was a motion to dismiss the defendant's counterclaims that was filed. And as part of the grounds for setting aside counterclaims, Mr. Lansky again made a standing argument. And that's what the trial court was referring to.
I think that this was done on the trial court's order granting defendant's motion to vacate order for publication and decree. So there may well have been standing arguments made later on, but this was at the very beginning with regard to the motion to vacate.
I understand. I misspoke. What I meant to say to you was the standing argument that was referred to in the order vacating the decree was that my clients did not have standing. There was an effort made by Mr. Lansky in the brief to suggest that there was a standing argument made in the motion for summary judgment. There was no standing argument made to the trial court at the motion for summary judgment stage. That's all I'm saying. They were contending that because they had shrunk the land, that we lacked standing. That was never before the trial court. What was before the trial court was the principle of law that a claimant to property in a quiet title proceeding must rely upon the strength of their own title and not on the weaknesses of his adversaries. So that's a different proposition, as you understand. We weren't making a claim to this property. We weren't claiming to own it. But we were in the case. We were in the case because we had been named as a party by Mr. Lansky. Mr. Lansky filed his amended and supplemental complaint, and in it he alleged that the trial court directed him to name all these individuals as party defendants. If you go back and if you look at the order of June 15, 2009. That's not what the trial court said. The trial court can't say you must name them as defendants. What the trial court said to Mr. Lansky was you need to serve these people a copy of a summons and complaint. They need to receive notice, is all he was suggesting. So Mr. Lansky, on his own, voluntarily went out and named individuals as having an interest in the property, and they included all of my clients. Now, as named parties in the lawsuit, they certainly had standing. You can't suggest that they didn't when we were voluntarily named by the defendant. Mr. Lansky argues that the trial court erred in granting the motion for summary judgment because there was a genuine issue of material fact on the element of adverse possession called tacking. The arguments to the trial court in opposing the motion for summary judgment did not include an allegation that there was a material a fact issue with regard to tacking. The argument that was made was that they had equitable title and therefore they were not subject to the motion for summary judgment. They argued that the defendants must rely upon the strength of their own title, but you will see that there was never anything said in the opposition to the motion for summary judgment about tacking. Mr. Lansky's argument that there are genuine issues on this element are flawed. There is no evidence of tacking. There's no evidence of a predecessor's identity. There's no evidence of the period of possession by any predecessor. There's no evidence of what property was actually possessed. There's a dearth of any evidence of any tacking, and it wasn't even argued by Mr. Lansky at the trial court level.
Evidence as far as how long the Valdez family occupied the house?
The trial court had heard the companion case, the 02CB38. And in that trial, there was evidence of how long they had been there and perhaps findings of fact in the final order.
Castro case?
In the Castro case. The trial court did not err in awarding defendants their costs and attorney's fees. The trial court exercised its discretion correctly to punish Mr. Lenski and his attorneys. They were stubbornly litigious. They repeatedly opposed the defendants with meritless arguments. And the best example of this offensive conduct, this offensive judicial conduct, is Mr. Lenski's motion to dismiss the defendants' counterclaims. Now, the counterclaims had been filed, as the court had directed, following the vacating of the decree in June of 2009. He filed his motion attacking those counterclaims 5 months later, right after we'd had an evidentiary hearing, right after the court had made it very clear that the standing arguments being advanced by Mr. Lenski were meritless, right after the court had said to Mr. Lenski that you have to start over. And so what does Mr. Lenski do? He turns around and makes these arguments that we had failed to state a claim, that we had failed to join indispensable parties, that we had no standing to assert counterclaims, and that we were not the real parties in interest. Your Honors, Mr. Lenski commenced his quiet title action without knowing the boundaries of his lands. Now, I disagree with my opponent. I understand what the Taylor case says, but you have to understand this parcel is right smack in the center of a community. Mr. Lenski could look out his back door and see Chuck Coyne's house in the field where Chuck Coyne parked his trucks. And you could look over and see Mr. Trujillo in his liquor store. Never before he even commenced this action did he ever take the effort to find out where the boundary was of that very lengthy meets and bounds description attached to his complaint. He didn't find that out until 2007, nearly 6 years later.
So I asked him if a record search in 2001 would have come up with the defendants. And
yes, the affidavit of our surveyor established that, as well as his testimony in the hearing in October of 2009. Yes. Those deeds were of record. And yes, if Mr. Lenski knew what he was doing and or had asked the local title company who confirmed that those deeds were of record, yes, he would have found the deeds. And if he walked over, he would have seen that my clients were in possession of the property. And as possessors of the property, they had a right to receive notice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kettlecamp.
There's a quiet title maxim that says that you have to rely on the strength of your own property, of your own title, and not attack somebody else's. That's where things went wrong. The defendants here never asserted title to the 21 acres that's left over after they claimed their bits around the edges. That's why we ended up, after the trial court got done with this case, with 21 acres of no man's land in Gardner, Colorado. That's wrong. That needs to be fixed.
Typically, standing is a plaintiff's concept. It means that you have a right to come into court. How does it work with defendants? You bring them into court, and then all of a sudden...
Doesn't matter.
Complaints amended, and they're out of it.
Show up as a plaintiff, show up as a defendant. You better have title. If you don't have title, goodbye. They didn't have title to that 21 acres.
So, do you have any cases about defendant standing as opposed to asserting title?
Oh yeah, the brief is full. Let's see.
Seems like defendant standing is usually lost when a defendant defaults. They lose standing to attack the merits, but
Bennett versus Morrison, the fairly recent case of Meyer versus Haskett. That was a defendant trying to claim title. That's from the Colorado Court of Appeals from just last year. So the whole plaintiff defendant thing just doesn't work the way it does in most cases. You're making claims for title. If you have a claim, make it. If you don't have claim to somebody else's title, you can't complain about it. The way to think about this is that there are lots of different square feet out there. Each square foot of that 22 acres is not fungible with all the rest of them. The Castros, say these seven chairs are the quiet title property. The Castros claimed a chair over here. The DiDomenico's claimed a chair over here. But the other five were not claimed by anybody but Mr. Lenski. So you have to look at each piece of property, each little piece, independently. And I think that's where there's kind of some confusion here.
Your time is up. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you again, Mr. Kettlekamp. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. Mr. Kettlekamp, we appreciate your coming here from Pueblo, and we appreciate, Mr. Lenski, your coming from Gardner, and also anybody else in the audience who's come here to attend the oral argument. We appreciate your presence as well. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.